This time, they braced themselves for the elevator car's splash landing and managed to keep their feet. When the doors opened, a wave of brown water poured in, filling the car to the height of their shins. They faced a floor-to-ceiling, barred vanadium steel gate. The gate door had been left ajar, presumably a century ago, by fleeing whitecoats. The companions sloshed forward into the still-flooded lab. A few of the recessed ceiling lamps had survived, and they threw pools of light onto the dirty water as it swirled away. The current was running strong toward the far end of the floor. The rips sucked away pieces of paper, styrofoam cups, even chair cushions. The banks of computers were dead, their cracked monitors full of brown water, as were the open desk drawers. The laboratory's countertops had been swept clean of glassware. A row of slime-streaked bright yellow biohazard suits with helmets and self-contained breathing systems hung from a row of hooks along one wall. In the back, eddies formed by the corners of the desks, clots of unidentifiable shapeless things, all hairy green or foamy brown, spun in endless circles. Along the joint of the walls and ceiling was a greasy black ring, the floor's high water mark. The lower walls were covered with mold slime, as was every exposed surface.
It looks like a giant petri dish.
Smells like a giant latrine.
Whew, ain't that the truth?
They slogged on toward another barred barrier that divided the lab floor in half. In front of the steel fence, a thick red line had been painted across the ceiling and walls, and presumably also under the water on the floor, a demarcation line. Riveted to the barrier's open door was a stenciled notice. Warning, extreme biohazard. Absolutely no unprotected personnel beyond this point. The companions pushed through the gate into what had once been the lab subject containment area. Along one wall were rows of screened stainless steel cages, stacked three high. The critters inside them were 100 years dead. As the retreating water had drained from the cages, it had peeled away their covering of slime. Hairless, featherless, scaleless bags of gray skin lay on luxuriant beds of scum. It was impossible to identify their species, or which end was up.
Phew. Damn.
A quintet of much larger enclosures stood at the far end of the room. The cells were 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet, and separated by enough floor space so the lab attendants could wheel gurneys and supply carts around them. Gurneys and carts that lay overturned near the back wall. These cages had vanadium bars, horizontally reinforced, like the room's security barriers, but inside the enclosures, covering sides and top, were sheets of clear plastisteel with neatly drilled rows of ventilation holes. The lab designers wanted no part of what was inside those cages to get out. 4 of the 5 cells were half-filled with cloudy water, which still drained out the breathing holes. Above the waterline, slime froth streaked the inside of the plastic. On the wall beside the cages was a tall locker marked Emergency Response. When Jack opened it, gallons of water rushed out of the bottom. Inside the compartment was a pair of flat, black metal tanks, joined in an aluminum back frame with webbed and padded shoulder straps. A corrugated steel hose led from the inverted tanks to the butt of a pistol grip device, complete with trigger, trigger guard, cross-block safety switch, and an unmarked red plastic button. Atop the pistol grip was a pipe that ended in a fat nozzle. Directly under the nozzle was a second, slightly longer length of metal tubing, bent upward at the tip. It was the diameter of a soda straw. An igniter. The weapon system's pilot light.
Good grief, that's a flamethrower.
A devastating weapon in close confines, and an excellent way to contain a disaster within these 4 walls. It combines lethality with sterilization.
Thanks, foe.
It looks like Bob and Enid never got the chance to use it. Whatever happened down here, it happened damn quick.
They sloshed closer to the line of large cages. The retreating water on the floor was now shoe-top deep. In the closest cage, something big and white was drifting low in the water, fluttering weakly as it continued to drain away. The trapped liquid was dark, murky, the lighting was bad, and the object was far from the inside of the plastisteel wall. They couldn't make out exactly what it was. Not until more of the water oozed away, revealing a much larger skin bag on the cage's floor. A skin bag wearing a white lab coat. The bones of the man's skull and neck were visible through the sags and rips in the loose gray skin.
There's another corpse in the cage over here. It is also wearing a white coat. It is in rather remarkable condition, all things considered.
That's got to be due to the water temperature. It's been nice and cool down here for 100 years. It was a fairly sterile environment to begin with, and thanks to the flooding, there was no aerobic bacteria to deal with.
Were these people experimenting on each other?
Hardly seems likely.
Why are they in the cages?
Maybe they climbed in to get away from the trannies. Those cages could have been their only hope. It's obvious they couldn't reach the flamethrower in time, and the elevator was even farther away. I think they ducked in the cages and shut the doors behind them. I think that's all the time they had.
And Bob and Enid drowned them, too.
They were cutting their losses. Under the circumstances, they couldn't try to rescue their people down here. They had no way of knowing whether they were still alive. They wouldn't risk letting the trannies reach the upper floors. If that happened, every person in the redoubt was going to die. So they sealed off this section and flooded it.
Ghastly.
They died like rats in a trap.
There were three more of the large cages at the end of the room. Beyond them, in the light of flickering lamps, the companions could see the entrance to the emergency escape tunnel. The heavy steel door stood half open. Above it was a red warning beacon siren unit, an alarm system that alerted the redoubt when the corridor had been accessed. Water still flowed out that way, but in inches now, instead of feet.
Maybe one of the white coats tried to get out through the tunnel.
Or the demons somehow managed to get the door open. Or Bob and Enid sprung the door themselves to flush the demons out of the lab and force them into the tunnel.
Some demons not make it.
The falling water level exposed the bottoms of two of the remaining cages. Thick coatings of scum covered the lower limbs, but the heads, backs, and torsos of curled-up forms were visible. The trannies' hard external skeletons showed no evidence of decay, but their soft parts hadn't fared so well. The eye sockets were huge, empty craters. Their bellies had rotted, as had the bands of tough connective tissue between their armor plates. The full force of gravity, which now bore down on them, was pulling their torso plates apart, exposing the voids between.
Behold the mighty Minotaur brought low.
Bob and Enid's babies, you mean? They managed to chill two of them.
At least this affords us solid proof that the beasts are not immortal.
Yeah, but it took upward of 75,000 gallons of water to do the deed.
Christie approached the lab's last cage. The water had already run out.
This one is empty and the cage door is open. It looks like one of them got away.
A single escapee set all these destructive countermeasures in motion?
One of these things is all it takes. Remember, they don't need a mate in order to reproduce. Once just one of them gets into the walls of a large structure like this, it'd be almost impossible to eradicate. Trannies can't be pursued into their burrows because of the powerful acids they secrete, and because of the danger presented by their other weaponry in close-quarters combat. To clear a redoubt of these invaders, you'd have to tear the place down, inch by inch.
Be easier and safe to just walk away.
The data I scanned indicated a rapid breeding cycle in a short time from birth to sexual maturity. Bob and Enid designed the trannies to double their population size every 2 weeks. If they had ever been deployed, in a few months the demons would have outnumbered the Soviets, assuming there were any left by then.
How many could there be 100 years after one escaped?
Hard to guess on that. The population probably spiked early on and then fell back and leveled off. A sustained population would depend on the number of offerings they were given, and on the room for colonization inside the dam. Trannies are extremely territorial. They fight each other for control of the available turf.
Why did the redoubt survivors decide to feed these ungodly brutes? Once they were in the dam, why not just seal them in and starve them to death?
Sealing them in is impossible. They could come through dam walls anywhere.
But you said they have an aversion to sunlight.
That's right, they hate it. And they'd avoid coming in contact with it at all costs. They don't like open spaces above ground either. But they'd forego their instinctive preferences to hunt in the open at night if they got hungry enough. The Vilfolk are no match for them, and they know it. Their only option is to keep the demons content to remain where they are.
Why feed them people?
Soylent Green, baby.
Huh?
Nothing. Anyway, after Nuke Day, there weren't any other large animals left in the canyon. Besides, the trannies were bred to chill people. We are their meat and potatoes. Their sensory array is tuned to locate and track down human beings. Their gut enzymes are constructed to digest us. Again, this is primary weapons control. Bob and Enid couldn't have their demons running around chasing after Ukrainian sheep.
Tranny chill time.
Jack shrugged into the flamethrower's straps.
Have you ever used one of those before?
I tested first.
Jack flipped off the pistol grip safety switch, aimed the nozzle at one of the cages about 15 feet away, and pressed the red igniter button. A fine blue flame shot out of the tube beneath the nozzle. Then, Jack pulled the trigger.
Turn it off! For God's sake, lad, turn it off!
Phew.
Luckily, everything was still so waterlogged that nothing in the room caught fire. The plastisteel walls of the target cage had blackened and partially melted. The ceiling above it was badly scorched and blistered. Jack had to check out the weapon, though. It was their best hope against the trannies. Maybe their only hope. There were no operational lights in the escape passage. Visibility ended about 20 feet down it. Hurriedly, the companions scrounged through the lab for materials to make torches from. Christy found a water-filled drawer packed with surgical supplies. She and Mildred quickly stripped the wads of sterile bandages and dressings from their sealed foil pouches. Doc broke the legs off a tall stool, and they wrapped the ends with the bandages, creating a torch for each of them. A liberal dousing with rubbing alcohol made the material catch fire at once. The redoubt's escape passage was very narrow, with a low ceiling. Doc had to bend over to keep from bumping the top of his head. The tunnel's featureless wall stretched off into the darkness at a slight down angle, which helped with drainage. The heavier lab debris had been deposited on the floor as the water level dropped. The litter included computer diskettes, CDs, plastic labware, pipettes, hoses, test tube racks, and pieces of broken glass. The companions advanced with weapons drawn and safeties off. With the exception of Jack, they all carried shoulder-slung canvas bags with extra ammunition, speed loaders, and grens. The albino walked in front with the flamethrower's business end in one hand and a blazing torch in the other. With a flick of the wrist, he could fill the passage from wall to wall with fire. Whether that would be enough to chill or turn back an attacking demon had yet to be proved. There was really no room to maneuver in the escape tunnel. It was so narrow they were forced to walk single file. Their customary procedure in a situation like this was for the point man to kneel left and fire when they met opposition. The second gun knelt right, and the third and fourth gun stood and fired over their heads. The kneeling pair didn't rise to their feet until the shooters behind gave the clear signal. Jack abruptly stopped the column and held his torch near the wall to the left. In the dancing light, they could all see a narrow vertical depression in the surface, about 6 inches deep and 3 feet in length, where the acid-softened concrete had been scraped away. The depression was cross-hatched with talon marks.
Oh, tranny work.
It tried to tunnel out.
I wonder what made it stop.
Maybe it realized that direction was a dead end, that it couldn't burrow any further. It probably has some way to sense the depth of the concrete. It could be something like sonar. Or maybe it can taste the difference.
Or the water started pouring in and it had to run.
I don't think it would have made it, if that was the case. Bob and Enid were trying to kill it. They would have closed the passage at the other end before they opened the floodgates. They wouldn't want to risk it getting past the barrier and into the dam.
But it did anyway.
Could have gotten spooked by something and taken off. Got by the door at the far end before it closed.
Things moved that fast?
Fast isn't the word for it.
The companions continued down the tunnel at a careful trot. They found no other evidence of demons at work on the walls. They found a lot more debris, though, some of it slippery underfoot. The passage ended in what at first appeared to be a blank wall. As they closed in on it, they could see the mouth of a 3-foot-wide drain pipe set at ground level. Doc got down on his knees and peered in, the torch and the cocked lama thrust in front of him.
I cannot see any light, but there has to be an opening at the other end. This is the drain line. It could also be a continuation of the escape tunnel.
On the wall to the left of the open pipe were a series of steel rungs leading up to a dark, circular opening in the tunnel's ceiling. The top three rungs were bowed, as if by a tremendous weight.
That way into dam.
There used to be a locking hatch up there. I can see the lip of the ceiling ring.
Jack passed his torch to Doc and climbed the rungs first. With the flamethrower pointed above his head, he hit the igniter button and used its flame to see by. Mildred came after him, her check ZKR ready to rip. She scrambled out into the horizontal passage, and Doc tossed up their torches. This tunnel had been filled with water, too, because the floor was still wet. There had indeed once been a locking hatch that secured this end of the passage. Its lid was flopped back on twisted hinges.